Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the Endangered Species Act appears to be itself endangered. Some say the act infringes on the rights of landowners, but many believe the law is sound and must stay strong. We'll hear a portrait of Angel Falls in the Amazon, and we'll take in a debate over the future of solar energy. Recent advancements suggest widespread use is only a few years away, but some say it will never materialize. We look at whether pesticides in food is really something to worry about. Efforts are underway in Congress to change the standards. And our Earth calendar looks at the scarlet kingsnake, now showing its true colors. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act is on the agenda for the 104th Congress. That groundbreaking piece of legislation passed over 20 years ago with bipartisan support. It provides for the listing of plants and animals as threatened or endangered when biological data reflects that extinction is imminent. When a species is listed, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is required to draft a recovery plan to provide for its survival and recovery. Usually, this involves protection of habitat. For example, the recovery plan for the spotted owl in the Northwest forbid the cutting of some ancient forests and spotted owl nesting areas. Intense opposition to the Endangered Species Act, led by conservative members of the current Congress, came to a head in April 1995 when Senator Hutchinson from Texas tacked an amendment on a defense appropriation bill which put a moratorium on any new listing of endangered plants or animals. David Wilco, senior ecologist at the Environmental Defense Fund in Washington, describes the impact.
The moratorium is preventing the Fish and Wildlife Service from listing or proposing any new endangered species. And that means that an awful lot of species are in limbo and denied the protection of the Endangered Species Act. So what we have are about 250 plants and animals that are clearly ready to be listed. The Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed them for listing, but they can't finalize those listings. And so these species receive none of the protection of the Endangered Species Act while the moratorium is in effect.
Last week, Senator Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, led a spirited fight to lift the moratorium. He was backed by Republican Senator Chafee from Rhode Island. Reid was not successful because by a 51-49 vote, the Senate adopted a substitute amendment by Senator Hutchison which modifies the moratorium to provide for certain emergency listings but appropriates only $1 to support the effort. Senator Reid says he won't give up the fight.
I tried to explain on the Senate floor that when you have something go on the endangered list and become extinct, that's forever. If it's extinct, that means it's gone forever. And that's what we're fighting here, is people who are so short-sighted that we're losing plants and animals forever. And it's more than being concerned about plants and animals. 80% of the pharmaceuticals most frequently used were first identified in living organisms. And 40% of medical drugs were first extracted from other life forms. I mean, we're talking about serious stuff. Doctors say what's going on now is absolutely wrong. The cures for diseases may be lost forever. So I'm going to continue this fight. I've just gotten warmed up.
Senator, the strategy appears to be to prevent listing rather than do things to the act itself, and that's going on within the budget process. Is that a strategy that the opponents of the act will continue to follow?
Yes, what the opponents of the Endangered Species Act have done is they have a moratorium now to prevent any future listings. What this means, as long as we have this, there are people in the Congress who say, fine, we have in effect killed the Endangered Species Act, and we don't need to do any more. most of us believe here in Congress that the Endangered Species Act needs revision. You know, it's an act that we've seen how it's worked over the years, and we know it needs to have some changes to it. But these are changes we can make very quickly, make the act more consumer-friendly, make it so that it's more understandable. And that's what we're going to do if we ever get the opportunity. We'll never have that opportunity as long as this moratorium's in existence.
Opponents of the Endangered Species Act in its current form want to see it brought to the Senate floor for revision, and at the moment have the votes to keep the moratorium in effect until that happens. Former Senator from Idaho Jim McClure is chairman of the National Endangered Species Act Reform Coalition, which seeks broader protection for private property and an Endangered Species Act that is far more limited in its scope. He describes what he thinks is needed.
Right now, if a landowner believes there might be an endangered species on their land, the last thing they wish to do is to recognize its presence there and take care of it, because the actions sometimes are so draconian that they destroy the value of the land. We also believe the protection of the species actually results in the taking of the land, so that the private property owner is deprived of the use of his land. There ought to be some compensation for that private landowner. We think there are ways to use better science in the designation of endangered species as endangered or threatened, and ways to use science better in the designation of critical habitat. Those are kinds of things we think we need to debate and to resolve.
Senator Reed has argued that while the moratorium is in effect, we may actually be losing species which could be of benefit to mankind in the future. Does he have merit in that argument?
That's a reason to reauthorize the act. The same thing can be argued on the other side, that without the reauthorization and the amendment of the act, you'll do irreparable damage to some individuals. The question, I think, comes down to what's the appropriate balance between protecting individual humans and individual species. And I think that there needs to be a balance that isn't there in the current act and the current administration of the act.
The bottom line is there is strong disagreement as to whether the Endangered Species Act should be continued or severely curtailed in its scope. Meanwhile, the moratorium on new listings means that species now endangered but not yet listed are without protection. I'm Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. They could be places in the middle of a city or somewhere deep in the wilderness. For Janice Jordan, an author-explorer whose recent children's book is entitled Amazon ABC, the special place is Angel Falls in Venezuela, which she described for us from her home in London.
It was only our second time in the jungle, and we planned to go to a mountain called Iron Tupui, which is enormous. It's 10,000 feet high, and it has a flat top, which is more than 1,000 square miles in area. We plan to spend about 4 months travelling around this mountain, eventually going in a canyon to explore and reach Angel Falls, the highest waterfall in the world. The first canyon we explored was a canyon called the Ionda, and it was a very narrow canyon with a very narrow little river running in it. But it was absolutely full of flowering bushes, orchids, and fantastic little jewel-like hummingbirds. But after about a couple of weeks, the water ran out, and we couldn't get our boat down the river anymore, so we moored the boat, and we walked to the end of the canyon to see if we could find jaguars, sleeping in caves on the way. But we saw quite a few jaguars, but not the rare black one that we were looking for. So eventually we came back out onto the main Caral River again and set off up to find the Churun Canyon where Angel Falls was. Once we got in the Churun Canyon, there were 79 sets of rapids to go up, and it was really, really hard work. But it was compensated by the fact that we saw more wildlife than we'd ever seen in our life before. We saw spotted cats like ocelots and margays. We saw herds of peccaries. We saw a tapir and heard it at night whistling for its mate. And then one morning when we were loading the boat, across the river, out of the jungle onto a little shingle beach, came a fully grown black jaguar. It was so close you could see the rosette patterns on its fur. It was just an amazing experience. But a thing that we found very strange that we hadn't expected was how noisy the jungle was. All day long it's noisy with frogs and all sorts of insects whizzing and making all strange noises, and then cicadas and frogs in the evening, and then you get noises like trains going through and phones ringing and people laughing, which we never identified what they were. And one morning we had a troop of howler monkeys went over past our camp, and it is an incredible noise. It's just like a monster coming to get you. But it was wonderful to see it all. And then one morning, after about nearly 3 weeks on the river, we went round a corner and there was Angel Falls. And it was just the most moving sight in the world. It's half a mile high and it just dropped like silver water. It's absolutely fantastic. So we climbed up to Angel Falls and stood underneath it. And it's almost silent. You don't really hear any noise, particularly in the dry season when it's so narrow. But you get sprayed by this wonderful spray, and it's just a magical place. So we stayed there for 2 weeks. And we really thought we were in paradise. We felt that the whole area belonged to us, and we never wanted to leave. But then we ran out of food and decided we'd better go back. But that night, there was a thunderstorm, which heralded the beginning of the rainy season. It had come in early, and we were trapped there for 4 days. The river rose about 15 feet. Everything was soaking wet, and Angel Falls was just absolutely enormous. It roared like thunder. But eventually, after 4 days, we decided to go home, and it took nearly three weeks to get up that river, but we got down it in 1 day. And we've never been back to Angel Falls, but perhaps one day we will, just to see if it's changed, and I hope it hasn't.
I'm Peter Burley. We appreciate all the mail and the email you've been sending us, and we're always interested in what you have to say. So write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or contact us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or reach us on the World Wide Web at www.wamc.org/env. That's www.wamc.org/env. You can hear The Environment Show anytime on the World Wide Web. Just go to our webpage, click on the Real Audio, and follow directions. Still ahead, a debate over the future of solar energy. Some say it will hit the mainstream soon, and others say it's just a dream. We'll look at efforts in Congress to change the rules relating to chemicals in food. And our Earth calendar chases the elusive scarlet kingsnake, now showing its true colors. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. The approach of the spring equinox brings longer days and more sun. While we've explored sustainable energy alternatives on numerous programs of the past, we've not considered whether capturing the direct rays of sun will be a significant source of power for America. Now we hear from two experts with opposing views in an Environment Show debate. We're joined by Jerry Taylor, Director of Natural Resource Studies of the Cato Institute, and Chris Flavin, Senior Vice President of World Watch Institute, locking horns over the question, should we expect solar energy to play a major role in our energy future? Mr. Taylor.
Well, absent an unexpected breakthrough in technology, economic, environmental, and geographic problems will probably limit solar's potential as a major power source. The high energy and industrial costs of constructing and maintaining solar power has limited it to about 1/20 of 1% of total U.S. capacity, and the cost per kilowatt is several times that of baseline energy. The environmental costs of solar are also very problematic. Panel construction is extremely energy and chemical intensive. And moreover, each megawatt of solar power requires 5 to 10 acres of desert land. So sprawling solar power farms would probably do to desert ecologies what dams have done to American rivers. I rather doubt that solar, unless we have some major breakthroughs, are going to be overcoming these sorts of problems.
Mr. Flavin.
Now, solar energy has a huge potential, and by sometime late in the next century will almost certainly provide most of our energy. In fact, some very mainstream research organizations, the World Energy Council, which represents big oil and coal suppliers, and even Shell Oil, have now come to the conclusion that solar is going to be key to our energy future. Now, the amount of land area required is not that great. In fact, three U.S. states could provide enough wind power to provide all our power generation. The state of Arizona could provide solar energy for the entire world, and most of our energy needs can actually be supplied using rooftops. Solar is a lot like personal computers. Costs are coming down dramatically. The markets have risen about four to five-fold just since 1990, and these technologies are showing the ability to substitute human innovation and ingenuity for the raw use of resources.
Mr. Taylor, in reply.
Major solar power generation is restricted to desert areas, and the loss of electricity on transmission grids mean it's going to only become a very localized power source at best. And the supposed consensus behind solar power just simply doesn't exist. A recent study by Resource Data International, prepared for the Center for Energy and Economic Development, a pretty highly respected group, concluded that even if the public subsidized 50% of the production costs of solar power, all renewable fuels combined would only compromise about 11% of the market by the year 2010, and in the process cost ratepayers about $203 billion in the process.
Mr. Flavin, the last word.
Well, Mr. Taylor simply isn't up to date on the latest technological development. These costs have fallen dramatically. You can actually generate most of the energy we need right in our cities. And the study that he cites is one that's funded by the coal industry. And if I were a coal producer, I would also put out that kind of propaganda. So the technologists really realize that this is the information revolution of the 21st century, and we're going to have a very different kind of energy system, fortunately for our children and grandchildren.
We've been joined by Jerry Taylor of the Cato Institute and Chris Flavin of World Watch. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Nobody likes residues of harmful chemicals in their food, but with today's modern agricultural practices, it's a fact of life. A law called the Delaney Clause was passed in 1958, outlawing 71 kinds of chemicals which cause cancer in laboratory animals. But a recent effort is underway in Washington to change this. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Every day, you consume carcinogenic chemicals along with your food. These are substances mainly used as pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides. The Delaney Clause is the most stringent regulation overseeing these chemicals, but food producers and many others say it's outdated and needs changing.
The clause says that any food substance in any amount whatsoever, whether it's a tablespoon or a part per quadrillion, if it is found to induce cancer in laboratory animals, cannot be used in food for human consumption.
Jeff Nettleman is with the Grocery Manufacturers Association of America. He says several bills are currently being considered on Capitol Hill to do away with the Delaney Clause. They would change the standard from one that says chemicals in food can have no risk whatsoever to human health to a standard that says chemicals at most must have a negligible risk. But some environmentalists say any risk is too much. Michael Colby is the executive director of Food and Water. He says changing the Delaney Clause will mean some people will die as a result.
There's no such thing as an acceptable risk when the risk is unnecessary. In this country, particularly since we're in the middle of a cancer epidemic, where 1 in 2.5 people will get cancer, that we should be talking about risk avoidance, risk prevention, and how do we produce food in this country that is as safe as possible. And I think if we really answer that question honestly, it's producing food without the use of unnecessary toxic chemicals.
Food processors say these chemicals are necessary and have enabled American agriculture to be so prolific. They also charge that Delaney actually harms public health because it actually keeps chemicals off the market, which might be safer than those used legally today.
We know that safer chemicals, safer by 1996 science, will be kept off the market because they technically violate a zero risk standard that no responsible scientist or medical organization supports.
Environmentalists counter, saying that the research is inconclusive and does not address the health risks to all people in all situations. Michael Colby says this is important since food is eaten by everyone, including infants, elderly, and sick people.
Well, surprisingly, we actually know very little about these chemicals, and almost everything we know comes from the scientists that work for the chemical corporations that are seeking approval for these chemicals. We do know, in the chemicals that I keep referencing as carcinogenic, those 71 chemicals, we do know that they do cause cancer in laboratory animals and potentially in humans in the long run.
Although the voices calling for a reform to the Delaney Clause are many, no amount of science will convince some people that chemicals in their food are safe. Chemical-free food is available, so whether Delaney survives this Congress or is changed, the onus of judging whether these chemicals are safe or not falls on the individual consumer. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In the pine flatwoods of South Carolina, spring begins with a hunt for the scarlet kingsnake. At 2 feet long, they have red, yellow, and black rings that alternate around the body. The search for the SKs, as they are commonly known, is an annual event led by ecologist Whit Gibbons, who awakens each March to the lure of these elusive creatures. Often confused with a poisonous coral snake, these non-poisonous snakes feed on mice, lizards, and skinks by constricting them to death. But little else is known. The assumption, says Gibbons, is that they breed during the spring like most reptiles. Yet no one knows for sure. By tagging them, Gibbons and his students of the Savannah River Ecology Lab can track the snakes and study their whereabouts.
One way that's fairly effective for marking snakes is to use what we call a PIT tag, a passive induced transponder. And this is a little chip that's injected into the body. It doesn't hurt the snake. We've never had a snake harmed by one of these chips. And it's inert. It sits there, and then you have a monitor, sort of a handheld monitor, that activates the chip if it gets near it, and you read off a number. And so each snake then can have its individual social security number, as it were, so that then if you capture that snake again, you can know how far it has moved, you can know how much it has grown, if it's gotten bigger.
The scarlet kingsnake, says Gibbons, is a good example of some of the fascinating, beautiful animals that people are not aware of.
Is that they're the hidden biodiversity. In other words, this makes up a lot of the animals that are out in the forests, around streams, rivers, wherever, that they're there, but you don't see them. Which, of course, always leads to the next step, is that when we destroy habitats, we are destroying a lot more biodiversity than we see. Just because we don't see it doesn't mean it isn't there.
The Bible recounts that Adam and Eve lost their innocence after a conversation with a snake in the garden. Would the history of humankind have been different if instead of discussing apples, they had demanded that the serpent identify himself with his passive induced transponder? Scientists are trying to unravel all of the mysteries of nature. I, for one, hope they never succeed.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 325. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, assisted this week by Stephanie Goichman. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.